Wow, that's a lot of sirens. We're waiting for our friend Mike Clellan to get back here online. He said he was making himself some coffee. I heard the kettle whistling at his house there in the upper Midwest. I think I hear Mike coming back.
I'm here.
Oh, okay. Well, then let's plug in the speaker there. Can you hear me there?
You sound great at my end.
Well, then let me find my theme music, our theme music for this evening, which is the same as always. You know the theme music.
I sure do.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Hey, it's Radio Mysterioso here for the... Wow, why did they do that? No wonder it sounded so bad. For the 22nd? Is it 22nd, Mike?
It is this 22nd. Yesterday okay. Was the solstice, yes.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so the 23rd is tomorrow, unfortunately. We're doing it on the 22nd. Maybe that will have some import. 22nd of September 2013. I like to put a timestamp kind of once in a while on some of these shows. And as a promise, the guest tonight is Mike Clelland, who runs the blog site Hidden Experience. The only other thing I know you for, Mike, besides Hidden Experience, having some great conversations with you, is the as an illustrator, and particularly the illustrator of the Cryptoterrestrials, which I just got a hardcover copy of in the mail the other day.
And how is the hardcover copy?
Well, it's a hardcover copy, and it's just beautiful to have something, to have that book as a hardcover. They weren't, who was it? Patrick and Anomalous weren't, I don't think they were sending them out to anybody. It's just that were involved in the project, not that I heard. I just heard from Nick Redfern online that they had released a hardcover copy and he was ordering one, so I did the same thing. As I was opening the envelope in the car, I had my iPod on shuffle and an interview or a slice of an interview that I'd done with Mac popped up. As I was opening the envelope that had that book in it. So I get, oh.
It should be considered normal in a lot of ways, those kind of synchronicities. If I don't get those kind of synchronicities, I worry a little bit.
Really, either I'm not attuned to them, I don't notice them that much. So that one just kind of slapped me in the face. I think I had your level down there for a second while I was talking. I'm sorry.
How do I sound? I just got a new microphone. So.
That microphone sounds great. I think I might close one of these windows here because it's really noisy. So, I can hold the microphone as I do that, though. So how are you doing, Mike?
Very good. Very good.
I'm glad you had some time to talk to me tonight. I know you did this on short notice, and I thank you. As I started reading the piece that you sent me about the owls, I started realizing we'd probably have a lot more to talk about than I originally thought when I first said, hey, do you want to be on the show?
That's part of the reason I pressured you into I kind of needled you a little bit and said you got to read this thing. Yeah. So just because it feels like that's been more or less the direction I've been going in as far as the work I've been doing.
So people who are not familiar, And to refresh me, probably, what is the work you're involved in?
That is a very interesting question, because it's difficult to answer. There, I have a blog, and I've been doing, mostly my own written stuff is just my own kind of. I've made an effort to document my journey as I proceed forward with this stuff, and my journey in this, it's kind of sounds kind of lofty or something maybe, but what I'm trying to do is make sense of some experiences that I've had, and I'm not even sure why or how I ended up doing it, but I just decided to do it online in a really public way. And it's been really interesting, because it's what it's forced me to do, instead of just keep a diary where I scratch some stuff down and just kind of, hide it away from myself. I've been doing it publicly on a forum, and it, as silly as it sounds, I'm required to, pay attention to the punctuation and try to make it very clear and very understandable. So in doing that, I've posted a few long format essays. That owl piece is going to be part of a collection, some sort of published book. It's going to be a chapter in a published book. And this guy, Frank Zero, who's kind of a young guy out of New Orleans, is going to publish this book. I have no idea when it's going to happen. I think Christopher Knowles has a chapter in it, and I think Brad Steiger might have a chapter in it too.
Oh, wow.
Here, let me just do one little thing here.
Yeah.
Okay, I just turned your volume down a little bit. It was kind of loud. And
sorry about that.
No, that was me at my end. I just had to push it. So this blog has been kind of an outlet for me. I've been doing some audio interviews, and then I've done a few more or less long format, like magazine article length essays, and that the owl piece that I kind of pushed on you is one of them.
Yeah, but even further, wow, this thing sounds really bad. Even further back from that. If people are not familiar with your work, and I hesitate to call it abduction work or abductee work, because I don't think you want to call it that either, but what would be, if somebody just came into it cold, what would you tell them? What is your blog about?
If they were saying,
I want to read your blog, what's it about?
Well, I mean, what I say it's about is the UFO phenomena, abductions, owls, synchronicity, and mythology, or I phrase it some tidy way at some point, but yeah, sort of like how mythic imagery shows up in our pop culture. But mostly it is about the abduction phenomena, and I'm at this point kind of at peace with that term. There isn't really another term out there that explains it and that people will understand. I mean, the abduction is as loaded a term as it can possibly be. It's got tons of baggage attached to it, but that's the term we're stuck with.
Yeah.
There's experience or contactee, that kind of thing is, has its own baggage. So I kind of use all of them interchangeably.
Yeah, I never liked the term experiencer, because that's all you do in life is experience things. So what does experiencer mean? It just is a special version of the word.
Experiencer was an attempt to create a new word to try to distance itself from all the baggage from abductee.
So, right, exactly. If you probably didn't. I had an interview with Peter Robbins, and he worked with Bud Hopkins for many years. I had a kind of a long discussion with him on the show, and I kind of needled him. I said, look, Peter, most people, if they're not in the UFO subject, do not have really any idea what's going on, one. And two, they really don't have a real good idea of what's going on. And on top of that, they're quite highly, I don't know about skeptical is the word, I guess it is, about what the abduction phenomenon is. I am actually myself, even being around it for so long. But I can't explain to you, I could, because I think you know what I think. But I can't explain my feelings about it to anybody. But I did have some, I had some discussion with Peter along the lines of, how can you be sure? How can you be sure about all this? And what it came down to was, and maybe I'll have you react to this, was that he had been involved with these people for many, many years, and he had become convinced that they were experiencing what they said they were. I'm not so sure, but I'm not in the middle of it. And if I was, I might feel like he did. Because I'm sure there's something that's going on, and I'm sure some people have contact with something that isn't human. Past that, I don't really know what to say. What's your take?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a narrative that has emerged of, you know, that we have as a pop culture icon, you know, like that, you know, you sit down and watch TV late at night and turn on the cable sort of documentary things, and you'll see, you know, the image that's been sort of forced into our collective psyche, which is, yeah, you know, the people being taken from their bed at night or taken from a car on a lonely road and then taken into a craft and then medical exams being done and then being returned. Now, I have, those are very real stories in the sense that I have listened to, I don't want to exaggerate, but I mean hundreds, yeah, of people sharing stories, you know, exactly like that. And that's not in the context of books and stuff. That's people I've talked to. But the problem is, or the weirder part is, and the stuff that I'm attracted to is the stuff that goes beyond that, the stuff that, that is outside that boundary, which is exceedingly challenging because there's no easy answer to these things. I mean, there's an easy answer to that, to that scenario that I just explained. You know, they are us in a sense. You know, they, the UFO occupants, are, you know, basically, you know, us, except a few further down the path a little bit. You know, they've got bigger heads and skinnier bodies, but they're basically us, and they're doing what we do to polar bears in Antarctica or polar bears in the Arctic and you know, grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park. We, you know, we abduct them, we do medical exams on them, and then we put them back. So that is very, very easy for us to wrap our minds around that limited version of the story, but the story itself is so you know, multi-layered and challenging and also divergent in the way people will share their experiences. So you know, and I think that there is a level of theater at play. I don't know, you know, where on the continuum it is. Is it 100% theater? Is it, you know, is it just a little hint of theater here and there just to confuse us or distract us or just to comfort us in some way? But the, you know, but at the core, I'm quite convinced the overall phenomena is a real, something very real is at the source of this stuff. You know, everything else is up for grabs as far as what it may or may not mean.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess you would generally agree with what I said, that something, people are encountering something that is not human and they're interacting with it in various ways. That's as far as I'm going to take it, because it hasn't happened to me as far as I know. But I believe, because it's been happening over many, probably thousands of years in one form or another, that this kind of thing happens to people. Some contact with something else, which might even be physical on some level, but certainly is accessible by the psyche, or by, you know, in some way experienced by the mind. And I say that and people say, oh, well, you think it's all in people's minds. Like, that's really not exactly what I'm saying. Everything's in our minds. But there are various levels of experience, and how you can describe it and how you can describe it to other people and how it can be shared, which I don't think this can unless you've gone through it or gone through it partially. And that's another question for you. It's that you told me when we were talking about being sort of, you know, fence sitting about your experiences and maybe some of the ones of others. And then you got to a place where you just finally says, well, you said to yourself, well, I know this is happening. It's not a doubt anymore. I'm not going to put qualifiers on it. How did you come to that?
Okay. Well, that was an experience. A little bit was just, it wore me down. You know, I had pretty much come to that within the last year or so, kind of come to that conclusion. Like, listen, you know, the puzzle pieces are all on the table. You know, obviously not all the puzzle pieces are there. There's some blank spots in the puzzle, but it doesn't take much for me to step back and review, you know, the overall puzzle. You know, even with the missing things there, I can tell what the design is. And the message I was very clearly seeing, though I wanted to deny it and I wanted to fight it, was that, you know, like, I have been interacting, I use the very loaded term that I would be a UFO abductee. I hate using that term, but that's, you know, that's the one we're stuck with. And then I had an event in March of this year that just absolutely just sealed it. I mean, it was just at that point I could no longer pretend to be in the state of denial, because it just had dropped away.
Okay, well, that's that. I want to talk about that, but if you'd like, but for people that don't know you, how did this stuff start, and when did you kind of start? I mean, they can read your blog, but as kind of a thumbnail, how did these experiences start, and you know, how did you start to think, well, maybe they're more than just, you know, imaginings or dreams or whatever you want to call them?
So I'm 51 years old. I had an experience in 1974 as a 12-year-old boy, where I had a missing time experience, and that, you know, always just sort of sat there. I had figured out a way to deny it, and that same experience happened in conjunction with an odd orange flash in the sky. I was walking home from a high school football game on a Friday night with a friend of mine, and I can remember exactly where it was. I could put an X in the sidewalk.
I was just laughing. I said that's really specific.
Oh no, I know to the inch where we were standing. You know, walking along, and then all of a sudden, you know, poof, it felt like God flipped a light switch. You know, it was a very calm, lovely, I grew up in Michigan, very lovely autumn evening. I lived very close to the high school, so it was not like a long walk or anything like that. It was less than a half a mile, I think, or about a half a mile. So I walking home, we get to that little spot. It was in front of a friend's house. The sky lights up orange, just like, you know, click on, click off. It was just bright orange, and it was a really deep, rich orange. It was kind of like the orange that you would see, like the way coals burn in a campfire just as it's dying down. We both talked about it in the moment, like, what just happened? What do we see? Even as 12-year-old boys, we're like, that was not an explosion over the horizon. It wasn't lightning. It wasn't, there was totally silent. So it couldn't have been an explosion or something. A meteor didn't make sense. And when I got home, I wanted to be home in time to see a television show. This Friday night, I don't know if you probably remember the television show Kolchak, the Night Stalker.
Yes, of course.
Oh yeah. So that was, I was the perfect age to be a big, huge fan of that show.
Yeah.
And I got home, and it should have been around 9:30. And instead, my parents were angry at me. And I was like, what are you angry at me for? And they're like, well, you're 12 years old. You can't be out this late. You know? And then the 11 o'clock news was ending on television. So that would have put the time at about, 11:30. So it's between an hour and a half and 2 hours of missing time.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, this was way before, you know, first of all, there was no UFO involved. There was just this odd light in the sky.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this long before any kind of, you know, the literature would have, you know, have explained missing time. But so I just was like bummed out that, you know, that I missed this TV show. I was kind of annoyed at my parents for getting mad at me for something I didn't do. And I just dismissed it and forgot about it. Now, the next Monday at school, the kid, whose name was also Mike, he, you know, I remember very clearly we were in the cafeteria, and he said, I think I said something like, hey, something weird happened on Friday night. And he just blurted out, yeah, we saw a UFO with lights and everything. And my response was, I never saw that. I never saw a UFO with lights. And my initial reaction was that he was just lying, right? He was just making it up. It was just, you know, adolescent boy bravado, just trying to, you know, exaggerate. And I never brought it up with him again. So that happened in 1974. And then over the years, a few other things happened. And around 1990, I started reading UFO books somewhat compulsively. And that experience of the the missing time never quite went away, and there was a few other events that I just couldn't shake either. So, and I started to look into it, and the act of looking into it, you know, literally like calling up, you know, researchers and making phone calls and talking to people. And I befriended Leo Sprinkle, who lives fairly close to me here. He's a wonderful guy, or super helpful. He's like, oh, you should talk to this person. He'd give me this phone number, and I'd call this person up, and we'd have these long, long, long talks. You know, this person, you know, so I was talking to people who also had abduction type things in their lives. So it was very, you know, it was kind of a chaotic chapter of my life there. And it was in that chaotic chapter of my life that I started the blog. Now, one of the things that happened was, in 2006, I was somewhat like, it was kind of overwhelming. I was confronted with synchronicities, very profound, lined up exactly when I started looking into this stuff. And I started seeing owls at, you know, unusual places, you know, at prescient moments, you know, in a way that just defied normal owl behavior. So I kind of flipped me out, and that was right when I was starting the blog. So, you know, if you go back and read some of the initial postings I did in the blog, you don't have to read between the lines very far to sort of sense my, you know, anxiety and agitation over the whole thing. Yeah. And since then I feel like I've chilled out a little bit, but, so yeah, that's been the genesis of my public, you know, public in the sense that I'm online, is my online persona as far as how I've been looking into my own stuff.
Yeah. Do you have, I don't know, you don't reference, I think you talked about Bud Hopkins a little bit, but you don't reference anybody specifically as, well, this is the person I really share kind of who I look to as somebody that is somebody I agree with on this phenomenon, except possibly, and maybe I'm wrong here, Carla Turner.
Well, yeah, there's a bunch of folks I do reference, you know, Carla Turner, Bud, Leo Sprinkle, and John Mack,
yeah.
and Jacques Vallée. I really, you know, focus on those folks, and, you know, and Whitley Strieber, I really think that he's, you know, I don't know how to say it, less the researcher, more the poet in a way, which sort of taps into me in my, you know, my sensibilities a lot more.
Yeah, that's a, I don't know if you read it, but like 3 or 4 years ago on the UFO Mystic site, I wrote a two-part piece called "Are UFOs a Cosmic Art Project?"
That's as good an explanation as anything. Yeah,
yeah,
I mean, that's as valid as any other hypothesis. Sure.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't remember experiment. Reading it, but you know that yeah. that's.
It was a thought experiment. I think I don't know 3 or 4 years ago, whenever it was the site was up. And I was writing furiously on the site everything that I was thinking for the past few years. But, you know, I discussed a Renaissance painting, then like a painting by Picasso. And I said, what are these? How are these things communicating to us? What are they showing us? And how do they make us feel? And then compare it to the UFO phenomenon in the same way. What is being shown to us? What do we think it looks like? How do we interpret it? And how does it make us feel? And I thought in that way, and like when you said about Whitley Strieber being the poet or the artist, I guess I would think more, because my degree's in art history, so I think sort of in those terms. But, you know, being looking at the phenomenon, I think you do this too, from a creative standpoint and not a scientific standpoint. And I think that has as much, or at this point, probably more validity than the analytical viewpoint of whatever the phenomenon is, it turns out to be.
You know, there's two ways to pursue it, and you know, you can pursue it from your head, or you can pursue it from your gut.
Yeah.
You know, the pragmatic scientist would say, oh, no, you can't possibly pursue it from your gut, because, you know, we have to be men of science and we have to use logic, and we have to use. And my sense is that I'm kind of content to push that aside and go strictly by my gut. You know, obviously I do try to, you know, think logically is how I frame things and stuff. But as far as my intuition and stuff, I'm trusting that a lot more than I'm trusting. Cause if I tried to trust my logic, I would just look at the whole phenomenon and just dismiss it outright because it's impossible, right? It's ridiculous. It shouldn't. There's no proof of it. There's, you know, obviously there is some very, you know, strong proof of it, but you know that I would have to actually dig and find that. You know, so you know, it could just, you could look at it and say the whole thing's absurd and just dismiss it as such. And but my gut says just the opposite. My gut says, oh, there is something here. There is something going on, and it is a you know, like I've been confronted with a mystery, and I just can't turn away from it.
Yeah, just as you say that, I'm thinking, who has a scientist's brain and an artist's heart that looks at this? And the only person I can think of is Vallée.
Oh, that was what I was going to say too. Yeah. So,
maybe Keel in some way, maybe.
Well, I mean, he's almost, you know, I don't think he has that. He seems to be playing it from the role of, you know, I mean, I've read a bunch of his books, but, you know, my sense is that he was certainly working from an intuitive level, and I think he was following synchronicities.
Yeah. But he was also analytical about a lot of what he did, or at least he said he was, from what he found out, and the way he argued his points, they were analytical, but they were based on a lot of intuition. Based on all the people he talked to, information he gathered, and stuff he experienced, and I think that if you talk to a scientist and say, well, all this has to be, you know, put together scientifically, has to be reproducible, has to be, but the thing is, you have an idea of what your theory would be in the first place. You get an inspiration for that, and it might be partially based on your ideas about what should be or what you think should be happening, which is intuition. Because if you just threw all this stuff in a computer and told the computer come up with a scientific theory, it couldn't do it.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, no, I think it's also, you know, this is where, in a way, the synchronicity comes in. You know, that is something I've been trying to document and try to study. And I've been treating synchronicities very similar to the way I treat, like, someone who sees a UFO in the sky. If someone says they had a synchronicity, I will play investigator and ask them a bunch of questions. You know, like, what were you doing that was leading up to that synchronicity? What was the response to that synchronicity? How has your life changed because of that synchronicity? Now, those are the same questions I ask someone who sees a UFO or has some sort of contact experience. You know, what was going on in your life leading up to that? You know, how has your idea about reality changed since your experience? You know, how has your, you know, religious thoughts changed? How has your ideas about consciousness changed? Have you had any psychic experiences since that? You know, these are the questions I'm really interested in. I don't really bother asking the stuff that would show up in the MUFON Investigator's Journal, which is like, you know, if you held your arm at, if you held a quarter out at arm's length, you know, would it cover up the UFO? I mean, those are important questions, but you know, I'm not that interested in them.
Yeah. You know, what's funny that you say that, that you mentioned that, is I think I talked to you about this last time you were on. The last talk I gave anywhere on UFOs was basically, you know, what should be done with ufology. And one of my main points was get rid of big UFO organizations. Just get rid of them. And concentrate on small groups and individuals that can communicate with each other by internet or by calling each other or whatever, sharing their ideas. And you seem like, you know, as I listen to you more, you seem like one of the nodes of that thing that I thought would be really good for the study of this phenomenon or any kind of unknown phenomenon is kind of maverick thought and individuals with very specific ideas based on a lot of research and a lot of thought and a lot, as you say, intuition, and see if that bears any fruit, because gathering a whole bunch of dry data about stuff certainly hasn't brought us any closer, except that perhaps we can see patterns in that data if we look at it long enough.
And I'll tell you, MUFON has not done any sort of analytical, you know, statistical, you know, shuffling of their data. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, you know, like a college level, you know, statistics class could do, you know, just like, oh, here's a bunch of data, you know, plug it in and see what comes up, you know, you know, make a bunch of pie charts, figure out a way to, what is the data, you know, which MUFON has been collecting this stuff. I feel like I got some strong opinions about MUFON. I mean, they've been around for over 40 years now, and I don't see any conclusions. I don't see any them taking any kind of stand as far as, like, you know, here's what we've learned over the years. I mean, that might as well be just the first day they published the journal, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, me too. And the one thing I think I discussed with Chris O'Brien once, and I was saying, well, we don't have to get rid of the groups, but we have to get rid of their stranglehold on power. Everybody, let's look to this group.
No, I mean, nobody does. Nobody. I mean, yeah. I don't think that's going on at a grassroots level. What? I don't think anyone's looking up to MUFON for any kind of guidance because it hasn't shown any.
Yeah.
And
well, they keep changing regimes, so they don't really have. When James, what's his name?
Carrion.
James Carrion was in there. I interviewed him, and I had a lot of hope for MUFON. He said, "Oh, we're looking at putting all our data together, looking at it in different ways, looking at the psychedelic experience, a DMT thing, and see if that bears any fruit. We're doing, we're asking people about their personalities and just some of the questions you were just saying should be asked. Those came up in my interview with him. I was so excited, and then he quit.
Yeah, I never saw any of it, and I haven't seen any evidence of that being taking place in among the, you know, in at a top-down level. I mean, I'm not involved in MUFON, so I don't know. But, I'm this dirty guy that, like, you know, digs into this stuff all day long, on the internet and through books and through talking to people. And as well as I've had conversations with, folks directly involved in MUFON. There's a sort of a anemia at some level as far as taking certain parts of the phenomena seriously. And that would be, you know, one of them would be taking the abduction lore seriously. There's folks within MUFON who are doing abduction research. They are in essence doing it on their own.
Yeah.
They may have a few extra addresses in their email book than someone else might have. But so my I would love it if all of that followed through, you know. But I haven't seen it. Maybe it's in the works and it takes, you know, a few years for that to sort of filter out to where, you know, me, the outsider who does not, you know, is not a member of MUFON, can see that. But, what I'm much more interested in is the people at the, here's my sense is that, whatever, like, for instance, like I'm just got into this owl thing, you know, like I'm, you know, and then that just generates, I'm putting a lot of intention into that. It's generating its own weird owl synchronicities. It's, you know, owl information is, you know, arriving at me, at my inbox. Obviously, I have a website where I say, you know, if anyone has any interesting stories about owls and UFOs, please send them to me. And then I've been receiving them. So I'm making an effort to follow up on those and talk to folks. And if you Google my name, the first thing, if you Google owls UFOs, the first thing that comes up is my website. So if anyone has has a story to tell or is kind of looking at that kind of thing, I'm somehow, at the center of the hub in a funny little, you know, internet way on the owl UFO thing, which is, I don't think that's necessarily synchronistic magic. That's just, I've just generated it my own.
Yeah, you plugged away at it for a long time.
Yeah, I've just generated my own, like, online kind of connections there. But what has happened is, some really weird stuff is going on. Like, so I wrote this essay. This essay is about, I don't know, printed out, it's probably about 35 pages.
Yeah.
Do you know David Weatherly?
I know that name and probably from you, but that's as far as I know.
Oh, okay. He'd be a great person for you to interview. He wrote a book that was pretty well received recently called The Black Eyed Children.
I would love to talk to him. I wrote a piece on that like 5 years ago, and that's as far as it was taken. And it's nice. I referenced him in that article. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, he's great. He's great. So I did an interview with him and a while back, and I've met him at a few conferences it was interesting. He, while doing an audio interview with him on the Black Eyed Children's book, he said, you know, oh, as a boy, he had a near-death experience. I think it was a fever. He had a high fever.
Uh-huh.
And he said, yeah, as a five-year-old boy, he had a near-death experience. And I blurted out. I don't even know why I blurted it out. I just said, are you a shaman? And he said, yes, I am. And I was like, and it took me, I had to sort of collect myself. You can hear it in the interview where I'm like, whoa, 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 how did I even come on that, stumble on that? Now, so he had been studying shamanism. He's traveled all over. He's had an apprenticeship with a Native American guy. Really interesting story that he doesn't really share that often. But so I had some questions about shamanism for this essay. So I sent him the essay electronically and said, hey, can you just read this over, just read the shamanisms part and just make sure I'm not talking out of my hat? And so while he was reading the essay, he's at his desk, he's reading it on the computer, and all of a sudden something goes flip, flip, flip past his window, and he turns his head and looks out there, and this owl lands on a branch while he's reading the essay. And I say, okay, he said, oh, isn't that interesting? I say, how long have you been living at the house? He goes, oh, 20 years. So how many owls have you seen near the house? Oh, never one. That was the first time. So it's generating these kind of synchronicities that I don't quite know what to make of. I mean, that story I can repeat over and over again, where people basically will say, oh, I read your essay and then, you know, I saw an owl. That in a way is forcing me to I feel like I'm on a good path, right? Like, I feel like this is like a sign that says, oh, look, this is okay. You need to just proceed forward, stay on this path. You know, these are the mystical signs that are, you can use it to, I don't want to say confirm, cause that's a pretty strong term, but just, you know, like, okay, you know, keep going. And I don't know, I don't quite know what to make of it, I kind of stumbled into this thinking like, wow, you know, I have some owl experiences of my own. They sure seem interesting. Other people are sharing stories with owls. Yeah. People who have had UFO contact experiences or abduction experiences seem to, not 100%, but some percentage of them, when you ask them, like, oh, you know, have you already had any odd experiences with owls? I'll say, you know, in fact, I have. And then they'll share some very weird story.
What do you think that the connection is? Because I read probably 3/4 of the essay, because that's all I had time
for. Oh, good. Okay. You got an idea what's going on. Yeah. Then. Sure.
What it was, if people haven't read it, and Mike, if you want to tell people where to find it, I guess it's linked through from your site, too.
So if you go to my site, Hidden Experience, I'll just do this quick. So
yeah,
hiddenexperience.blogspot.com, or just Google my name, Mike Cleland. First thing will come up is this blog, Hidden Experience. Just go to the homepage, or any page, really, and then along the right-hand sidebar, scroll down just a little bit, there's a picture of an owl, and it says the owl essay. Owls and the UFO Abductee. And you just click on that, and then there's a PDF document you can either download or read online.
Yeah.
Or print out.
Yeah, so what I got from it is when you put that out there, which is, you know, if you become a clearinghouse for this information, this stuff starts coming out of the woodwork. Anything, actually.
Sure. Oh, I'm sure if I was, you know, researching shoelaces, I'd get all kinds of people telling me their shoelace stories. Yeah.
But the thing is that it's not something that normally people think about, except unless they're either reading your site or, to some extent, Whitley Strieber's stuff, because he pointed this out many years ago, too, which I don't know. He might have kicked that idea off in the collective unconscious or somewhere, and either people are, you know, either people made the connection to that somehow, or he opened a door, or it really is a specific, as yet pretty much unknown connection in the world of what do you want to, I hate saying abduction, but UFO abduction stuff.
Sure. I mean, it now, there's two lines of thought here. One is that there are screen memories, right? So someone says, oh, I was driving down the road and I turned the corner and there, you know, on the lonely dark road as I was driving home late at night is a 4-foot-tall owl.
Yeah, that's
it. Was standing there in the middle of the road staring at me. And then I arrived home and it was 3 hours later. So now, as a UFO abduction researcher, one could very quickly conclude that what they were seeing was not an owl at all and was quite probably the iconic gray alien. It may or may not come out under hypnosis, which is its own sort of, you know, ball of wax is trying to try to untangle those threads.
Yeah.
But that story I've heard so many times, you know, like, oh, I had this, you know, I mean, I've heard over and over again people, you know, say like, oh, I had this weird sensation. I felt like I needed to get out of bed. I got out of bed and I walked onto the porch and, and I was standing there and in the lawn right in front of the porch staring at me was this 4-foot-tall owl. And then, and the next thing I knew, I was back in bed, you know, and the sun was coming up. Now that story I've also heard in one form or another, you know, like so many times I just,
you can finish the sentence when they're telling you. Yeah.
Yeah, I almost want to finish the sentence. I'm a little too, you know, I don't want to roll my eyes or anything like that, because that experience is very that experience is very real and also potentially very traumatic for someone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that those kind of stories show up with an incredible frequency, and also deers, clowns, raccoons, clowns. And Jesus actually shows up a lot too. Curiously enough,
that's funny. I was going to ask you, any other animals show up associated with this, and you've just listed them off. Anything?
Well, there's also, I mean, other people. I'm sure there's other things that people will share, but you know, the implication is deer have those great big brown eyes, and raccoons have those, you know, big eyes, and
Jesus has those big eyes. No.
Well, Jesus doesn't have, I mean, Jesus has those big sad eyes when you look at him, you know.
If it's a Keen painting, yeah, okay.
Yeah, but also, obviously, if Jesus shows up there, whoever the tricksters are, or the UFO occupants, or the manipulators of the consciousness of the experience, obviously Jesus would be used, just because it has such a strong religious and emotional context for someone.
Yeah. Well, how much do you think it is being controlled by whatever this is? I've had this idea for the past few years, and people are probably sick of hearing it on this show, that we are contributing far more to the experience of maybe not a first kind or second kind encounter, but more when you get closer to the whatever the source of the sighting is, or whatever is associated with it, the intelligence, whatever you want to call it. The closer we get to it, the more we're contributing to the experience ourselves by putting our own layers of cultural baggage, personal, you know, bias, maybe subconsciously, collective unconscious. All this stuff is going into that mix, and I don't know, how can you be sure? I mean, how do you know how much is coming from that external stimulus and how much is coming from the person that's furiously trying to make sense of it?
Well, that's the challenge, isn't it? I mean, that's the game. I mean, have you ever seen the super, super slowed down lightning strikes?
Yeah.
So two things. So lightning is coming down from the sky at the same time lightning is coming up from the ground, and they kind of meet.
Right.
You know, so that's my sense. This is probably both, you know, and you know, what percentage is being generated internally by the experiencer or externally by the UFO occupants, I wouldn't begin to guess, but I don't think it's an either or
thing.
I think it's both and. I think a lot is taking place, from the subjective, internal, baggage almost that we all are, the file cabinets of our mind are just filled with this stuff, and it wouldn't take much for that to just sort of leap out and meet halfway to the UFO phenomena. So I don't have an answer to that, but that is as good a working hypothesis on how to proceed forward as any, I think, that, two things are happening at once. I mean, that's the, so if you treat a UFO abduction or a UFO abductee or a UFO sighting, you know, the UFO phenomena, let's just say, is collectively, if you treat that like a synchronicity, so there's some synchronicity researchers out there. There's a guy, Kirby Surprise, and there's another guy, Gibbs Williams. They both have written, rather big, fat books on synchronicity. Both of them, and the sort of working, in the more academic avenues of psychology, which I'm not a psychologist, so I'm just kind of mumbling through their hypothesis. I'm sort of like trying to paraphrase what they've already said.
Yeah.
Is that the events, synchronicities, are generated by the person experiencing them.
Yeah,
they are creating them somehow, the same way that someone at the particle accelerator can influence the outcome of their scientific experiment just by their consciousness alone.
Right. If I was going to write an essay about this, I would call it would be one word. It'd be co-creation.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, in a funny way, am I co-creating the whole owl thing? I don't think I am, because, people are finding, I basically am asking folks for stories. I'm finding some things in books that are, that have, or, you know, what I made. So that, that story I told about David Weatherly seeing the owl outside his window, you know, is some form of consciousness creating that? Is, well, let's say an aspect, an unknown aspect of our own consciousness, whether it's my consciousness, whether it's David's consciousness, whether it's the collective, you know, soup of humanity's consciousness, you know, that I think is playing a huge role in this. Now, it's interesting because I'm not, I mean, obviously I speculate and I, you know, babble on like this sometimes, but I'm less interested in, which I do, I certainly speculate in that essay and I, and other things too, but I'm less concerned with the speculation and more concerned with the story. I just think that as a, oh, what's the term? You know, I mean, you were probably about the right age to watch In Search Of on, you know, with the Leonard Nimoy narrated, you know what I mean? That, that TV show.
Yeah. I was addicted to that.
Oh yeah. So, you know, that there's this kind of like, there's this kind, there's this, just hearing those stories was so, you know, electrifying, you know, and I find that the stories themselves carry me, they transport me, they have a sort of mythic resonance to them, while the speculation of what may or may not be at the root of it, to me, is less interesting. It's a little more frustrating because, you know, you're sort of grasping for the unknowable in a way.
Yeah.
So I'm more interested in the story itself rather than the speculation that would come after the story. Obviously, I speculate it is, but I try to do it as little as possible.
Yeah. That's so exciting for me to hear that from somebody, that somebody is not lusting after result. It sounds to me more like what you're doing, which very few people do, is to let that journey and that, whatever that transport that you're talking about, that the stories give you and the accounts give you, sort of carry you along, and you see what happens with that without saying, I'm going to find out this, or this is going to be the root of this. Because as you're making that journey, stuff will probably be, and they already have, become more obvious to you. And maybe you can communicate that to other people, and it's already making, I think, kind of a big difference in the in examining this kind of phenomena. If it isn't, it should be. What you're doing and the information you're gathering and the kind of people that you talk to, because obviously, and we've talked before, and I remember at one point in our interview you said, "I'm going to have to really strongly disagree with that," and I can't remember what it was.
Oh, I don't remember either, but
when I hear you saying that you're not lusting after a result, that's an exciting thing to me, because I think, as we've been talking about here, once you start trying to put some sort of model on what you're looking at, or, you know, force it into something, that's all you're going to be concerned about later, is just forcing it into that model. And you reject a lot of stuff. I think Carla Turner was really... you know, instrumental in trying to get this across to people. It's like, don't lust after that result. She said, look at the anomalous details. I think that has a lot of importance, a lot more than people would think.
And that's something I you know, like how to say it? Like, I'm not really interested in the standard UFO sighting. Yeah. I mean, obviously they're very fascinating, you know,
of course.
But what I'm lusting after is the really weird, outlying, strange stuff, because it feels like that is what has intersected with my life more than, you know, like I've had more weird experiences than I've seen UFOs. Let me put it that way.
So it's more of a personal thing for you then too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had real owl experiences, and I've had real strange, powerful synchronicities. And you know, those. So my conclusion in the essay, in a way, is that you know, so like in 1993, in the winter, in January or February, I sat up in bed and looked out, and there was a bright light shining in my window, and I looked out my window, and right outside the window, actually fairly close. Pardon?
I'm still here. I'm all right.
I had a funny echo.
Okay, I'm just listening.
So right outside my window were five classic spindly gray aliens, you know, and I managed to deny that I ever saw them, you know, like I managed somehow to frame it as a dream. In looking at it now, there's a bunch of smaller clues that are connected to that. One of which is was a very profoundly real sensation that kind of implied an altered reality or a hyper quietness. The sensation was palpable in the moment of looking out the window and seeing that this head in the fishbowl sensation, this hyper clarity, things seemed strangely vivid, weirdly quiet. And I, you know, saw these entities. I looked past them. There was this bright light out in the snow. And I heard this voice in my head that said, now is the time to put your head on the pillow and shut down. And that's exactly what I did. I should have freaked out, you know, but I didn't. Yeah. You know, I should have got up out of bed, locked all the doors, and grabbed a baseball bat and, you know, and cowered in a corner. It was a freaky, nightmarish thing to see. The next morning, I never even bothered to go out and look and see if there was, like, you know, markings in the snow or anything like that. Now this is 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago now, and I've had that same sensation since then. That same distorted reality sensation, each time in conjunction with something very strange. And so it has forced me to conclude that event, you know, was real, because that the sensation showed up three other times in three other events that all had a strong kind of paranormal context. But anyway, so the point is, I guess I've had enough experiences that I shouldn't be, or I shouldn't have been, it seems like I'm at a different point in my life now, as you know, what do you call it, when you sort of like, I was standing my ground and I wasn't going to believe that this really happened. I was in such a strong state of denial. All that said is I would dance around the subject. I would, you know, I was fascinated by UFOs. I was reading all these books. You know, I was even doing these online, you know, blog stuff initially. What forced me to really think that, wow, there is something going on, was the owl sightings. These owl sightings I was having starting in 2006. And then also same year, 2006, right when I was kind of at the point where I was like, you know, I have to look into this. Like, I really need to look into this. And at that point, synchronicities and owl sightings show up. And I sort of treat all three of these things the same. You know, owl sightings, synchronicities, and UFO sightings, all I'm kind of framing them, maybe as this might be a mistake on my part to frame them so the same way, but I'm framing them all as the same thing. You know, treat them all the same way. They're all equally powerful. They're all in some way impossible, right? You know, profound synchronicity simply shouldn't happen. It's impossible that you know, the stars could align in a way to produce something like, you know, the synchronicities I've had. And the same thing with the owl sightings. You know, it's like, nope, it just shouldn't happen. That's not how it works. And it was less the overt UFO sightings or the things in the backyard or the missing time as a 12-year-old. You know, that wasn't convincing me of anything. What was convincing me was the onslaught of owls and synchronicities.
Well, synchronicities in which way? Because we have to maybe define for some people what a synchronicity is. To me, it's, well, you go back to the Jung definition, a causal connecting principle, and meaning there are two things that have no relationship to each other whatsoever, yet at a certain time, at a certain place, and for you, the person that's experiencing it, it can be or seems to be profoundly meaningful. Is that a good enough definition?
Sure. Yeah, and I have it written down here. I'm not going to try to look it up. It's hard for me to multitask on the computer at the same time I talk. And what the thing is that the experience is meaningful for the observer.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and I mean so here's the synchronicity. So I told you that story of which I may have told the last time I was on the show, but this one really sums it up well, I think. I remember I said I could put an X on the sidewalk right where the missing time yeah. orange flash event from 1974 took place.
Yeah.
So that happened to be right in front of a friend of mine, the girl from the neighborhood. We were exactly the same age. We went to, you know, kindergarten and everything together. Her name was Cindy.
Oh, yeah. This is a very good story and it's a really good illustration. Go ahead.
Yeah. So and it also is tied into this whole UFO thing. So Now, that event took place right in front of Cindy's house. In 2009, right when I started the blog, I realized I needed to, you know, initially all I wrote was a bunch of synchronicities. I've got a lot of them. There's some of them, they make great blog posts, right? They're short. They got a little punchline. So needed to tell this missing time story. I had it all written up as like a diary entry. It was, you know, it was kind of written up and spell checked, and it was a document just ready to drop in place, just sort of cut in place and put it in this blog format. I also had a Google Earth image of Cindy's house, which was down the street from mine, and I put an X on the sidewalk. I literally put a yellow X using Photoshop on the sidewalk, right where this other friend of mine were standing. Now, I 2009, this was in March. I remember I was skiing that day. I was cross country skiing that day. And as I was out there in the, you know, in the cold, and I was thinking to myself, like, today's the day. I got to post this. So I think there had been like four other posts on the blog. So this would have been the fifth post in March of 2009. So I get home. It's, you know, I eat dinner. I'm kind of at the computer. I'm kind of, you know, cut and paste. And, you know, here, I'll drop this in here. And I was just about to post it. And my hands were above the keyboard. And I literally seized up and I just said, I'm a coward. I can't go through with this. I'm not brave enough. Like, I am not brave enough. This is a big step. You know, you read this story, it sounds like a UFO abduction, and I am not brave enough to put that on, you know, publicly online with my name attached to it.
Yeah, understandable.
So my hands are like looming above the keyboard. I'm like frozen, and all of a sudden I hear this audible ping, and it was a, it's like, oh, great, an email came in. So that means I can, you know, I can just turn my attention away from this thing here and just look at something else. So I check my email, and I won't use her last name, but the email that came in said, Cindy wants to be your friend on Facebook. And it was from the same Cindy that lived in that house, and I had not seen her since 1975, and that would have been 38 years before.
Yeah.
And that was the moment she chose to Facebook friend me. And that's interesting. Two emails came in at that same moment. One was from Cindy, and the other one was from Whitley Strieber. And Whitley, which it was interesting because he said, Whitley Strieber is following you on Twitter. And now I joined Twitter because Mac Tony's told me to join Twitter as a way to promote my site, and I never did anything with it.
Yeah.
Like I think I put a few things out there that said, I put a new post on today, and that's all I ever did.
Yeah.
So these two things come at that audible ping, one from Cindy, one from, you know, the very individual that in a way personifies the alien abduction phenomena.
Yeah.
That event, I mean, I cannot tell you how magical it was. And I'll also add that Cindy was my very first elementary school crush. She had bright red hair and freckles, and she was super cute, and she was really calm. And my,
a little red haired girl.
She's the little red-haired girl that Charlie Brown fell in love with. Yeah, exactly. When I reconnected with her, I told her right away, oh my gosh, this is what happens. And she responded, which is a very unusual thing to say. And I've kind of pressed her on this, and she never came up with much. But I said, oh my God, this UFO thing. And like, you know, I'm writing this blog, and I, you know, here's this thing. And I just sent her the essay that I was just about to post. And she emailed back and she said, you know, oh, that's cool. You know, like I have a bunch of UFO books on my shelf. And there's not many people that have a bunch of UFO books on their shelves.
No.
So that synchronicity kind of, and I have a bunch of stories just like that, you know, that are somehow connected to the UFO thing. A synchronicity.
Yeah. I think some people attract more than others. And there's some people that notice them more than others, which is probably the main part of it, is you have to be open and observant. And I don't think I am, so I don't get nearly as many. The funny thing was, is what I said at the beginning of the show about getting the hardcover copy of Crypto Terrestrials, I opened it up and I actually looked. I said, oh, you know what? I really like that illustration of Mac walking out his house with his two cats and seeing the gray or whatever it is in the background there as he opens the door, the first illustration of the book. And I said, I want to look at that illustration again. I always like Mike's illustration, obviously, if people don't know. And right after I looked at that and said, oh, there's that illustration. That's so cool. What were the names of his cats? It was EBE, and I can't remember the other one. And then
spooky.
That's it. And then right after that, Mac's voice comes on my stereo in my car. And I can't remember exactly what he was talking about. I don't know if he was talking about synchronicity, but he was talking about some aspect of the UFO phenomenon. It was a really strange, and it made me laugh. I actually laughed out loud because I thought it was wonderful. And I thought, oh, maybe when I get back, maybe I should get in touch with Mike when I get home.
Oh, good. Yeah. Mac and I, before he died, were talking back and forth about, either on phone call or through email about me doing the illustrations for the book. And I basically said, listen, I'm doing them, you need them, I'm doing them. And I kind of, and then we talked about, he's a big fan of R. Crumb. So I purposely did the illustrations in kind of an R. Crumb style. And,
especially, and the big flower head thing that reminded me in Strange Way of R. Crumb.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so I was, basically said, listen, just chapter openers, it doesn't have to be much. And just, and he was all for it. And so we, this was like right, as approaching October. So this conversation was in the last few interactions I had with him. We're talking about this book project. And then, after he died, Patrick Weege got a hold of me and asked me, and at the same time I was kind of putting out feelers. I think I connected through his mom or something like that, and said, listen, I had been talking with Mac about this, and just can you forward, I'm not sure how. I was reaching out towards the publisher at the same time the publisher was trying to find me. So I said, yep, I'm going to do this, and I hadn't read the manuscript. So Patrick sent me, who's the publisher from Anomalous Books, Patrick sent me the manuscript as a PDF. And I got it printed up with the three-ring binder, and put it in a three-ring binder, printed it up at the Xerox shop in town, and then came home. And this was like a heavy thing for me. I was like emotionally, like, this weighed heavily on me, this project. So
yeah, me too.
And
I wrote an afterword for it, as people don't know. Another thing, I begged him to do that, and he finally relented on that too.
Yeah, yeah. So I realized I needed to start. Like, I'd been procrastinating. It was too big of a deal. It was too emotional. And I was like, realized, okay, today's the day I need to start. So I sit down at the coffee table. I got my reading glasses. I made a cup of tea, and I had the three-ring binder there. And I opened the three-ring binder. The house was totally quiet. I read much better in a silent environment. So the house was totally quiet. And I opened the three-ring binder and I read the first page. It said The Crypto-Terrestrials by Mac Tonies. And then I heard this audible clunk, and my CD player, my stereo, the CD player, which I hadn't turned on in a long time, had turned on and ejected the cartridge. It was like one of those cartridges that held six CDs, and it kind of turned on all by itself and ejected this cartridge. Now, I've had this thing for, it would have been close to 18 years or something at that point, and it had never done that before, and it chose that moment to do that. It just felt like, that was like, okay, here's like some weird sign. And as I've been doing, as the first thing I did is I wrote a blog post about it, which is interesting because I find that if I write them in the moment, like, I feel like they're pretty honest, and if I let the story kind of fade away, and then, like, oftentimes I'll read the things I write and I'll realize that, like, I feel like I'm just too polite a person. So, like, I'm really cautious not to exaggerate. So I'll undertell the story, and the story I wrote in the moment is often much more intense than the one I will tell, months later.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that was my kind of Mac synchronicity as far as opening the book too.
Yeah, and yours happened right when you were going to start doing actual work on it. I don't think I had anyone. Actually, I didn't beg him. I said, Mac, can I write the afterword? And he said, forward. And he said, Nick already asked me. I was like, can I grant the afterword? He said, okay. So Nick got to it. But
I did the same thing with this far doozy illustrations. I was like, okay, you need illustrations. You need chapter headers. What do you got for illustrations? I'm like, I don't really have anything for illustrations. I'm like, okay, I can solve that. So.
Yeah, so I'm glad that I'm so glad that I was able to at least get that, because to have the blessing of the author, who's a friend of mine, instead of trying to ask afterwards, which would have been, I probably wouldn't have done it, actually, was such a nice thing. Anyway, I had a couple more questions about the owls.
Sure.
So we've discussed what it's about, you know, what you think it's about. And the fact that it might be a screen memory or something like that. One thing I said to you when you said that's why you have to read this essay is I said I think grays are a screen memory. Or I think they might be. I can't make a definitive statement about anything on this, but I think our ideas about the what UFO occupants, the intelligence behind it, or whatever is behind this thing, and I think there is some sort of intelligence behind it. I think that we're going to create a screen memory ourselves, and maybe the whatever it is creating that screen memory of the cultural stereotype. And then you get that quote, two different quotes, one from Jacques Vallée, I'll be so disappointed if it turns out to be people coming in here in ships from other planets. And the second one is the one a lot of people use, the Terrence McKenna quote, where he said, I think that the UFO phenomenon uses the model of an alien invasion so as not to alarm us.
Yeah, and also Mac Toney's said, you know, well, if they can do these little screen memories and make us think it's an owl or Jesus, you know, why can't the whole thing be a screen memory?
Yeah.
You know, or why can't the whole thing be something projected into our consciousness? Which, now, you know, this is a slippery slope, you know, this is kind of getting into bong hit territory here where, you know, like...
yeah.
You know, like where's the line? I mean, you know, so I mean, people are obviously, you know, like I've been on investigations kind of thing. I've showed up at someone's house and he said, oh, here, let's look at the burn mark in the backyard. And sure enough, there's this big ring in the backyard. And he said, yeah, this happened last year. The grass hasn't grown back. And you know, he actually one burn mark like kind of intersected with his garden, and the vegetables were bigger inside the burn mark than outside the burn mark.
Classic stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, okay, so here's some physical stuff, like physical, real stuff. I'm standing there looking at it, you know, I didn't have to kind of squint and kind of pretend to see it, man. There was a round circle right there in the grass. And, you know, I've seen, you know, people have rolled up their sleeves and showed me scars, so there's this, you know, and I've had long talks with Roger Lear and about the you know, potential for implants so there is this physical stuff that has manifested. But at the same time, you know, the church, the Vatican, had done what amounted to systematic scientific studies of your hands bleed.
Stigmata.
Like, stigmata, yes, they have done, thank you. They have done, you know, investigations into people who report stigmata, and yes, there are these very anomalous things that can emerge. Now, are they just in such a heightened state of, like, religious ecstasy in a way that they are manifesting these wounds in a way that is, you know, generated from their self? It's not like they are, like, there's no indication that they're, you know, poking nails into their palms and having that event take place. It is some other mechanism is taking place, and it, you know, calling it a paranormal or, you know, event would seems fair. You know, is that how the burn mark in the yard is manifesting, like that, or is there a physical craft landing? You know, I quite honestly, like, you know, right now talking to you, you know, this conversation is generating a heightened sense of, like, yeah, man, it's got to be, you know, like right on for our consciousness, you know, kind of thing. And at the same time, I could then talk with more nuts and bolts researcher, and I would very much drink it in as a, you know, a real physical manifestation.
Yeah, well, that's why I like talking to you, Mike, because you've got this ability, which not many people have, to engage in, and if you know the term, I'm sure you do, model agnosticism.
Oh, I've never heard that term, but that's good.
It means that it's from, I believe, at least I think, that Robert Anton Wilson came up with the term, but he may have borrowed it. What it is being able to not cling to one model of whatever you're looking at or of reality or whatever for more than a little while. And being able to jump between them and not really have a prejudice against them and try to experience them, you know, at full belief level or whatever you want to call it, while realizing that you could switch out of it at any point.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good way to explain it. The way I've sort of said is that I'm so like weirdly empathic or empathetic, you know, like when I sit across from someone, right, as they go to a UFO conference and you sit in one chair and you're right next to the person in the chair next to you and they tell you this really intense story about like, you know, like the grim evil doctors and the horrible malevolent, you know, qualities of the whole experience, and I just get sucked right into it. I totally, like, you know, kind of live their reality almost. You know, I really sympathize for their, you know, their experience, and it just, and I've heard other stories like that, so I can, you know, so it falls into a pattern that I've already heard. Then I can get up from that chair, you know, walk around the corner and sit down next to someone else, and this person will tell me, you know, about how, you know, the beautiful angels stepped out of the flying saucer and that's who they interacted with. And they had this exalted higher consciousness where they tapped into the meaning of universal love. And I'll get just as wrapped up and just as drawn into that story. And it's only later that I kind of have to walk away and kind of like, you know, well, what is going on? And I don't have an answer. Because, you know, there's two divergent stories and both of them, there's evidence not just through the person telling me them, but through, you know, books on my shelf and other conversations I've had and other stuff that, you know, researchers have come up with and, you know, that can back up both of their experiences. And I am at a complete loss to know what, you know, I don't know where the core of reality is in this. You know, all I do know is that, you know, I trust both of those people, even though their stories are divergent.
Yeah, well, that's just to me sounds like plain old empathy.
Yeah, and I mean that's curiously enough, that's one of the things that shows up on you know, one of the things I want to do is go through all the abductee questionnaires. You know, there's a lot of them out there. You know, every researcher's got one, and some of them are like 80 questions long. Some of them are really dense. You know, Brad Steiger's got a really good one that he's been using for years, and you know, Bud Hopkins had one, and, you know, so there's these questionnaires that are out there, and I would love to just put them on a great big giant spreadsheet and kind of, you know, figure out, you know, some of them are going to repeat themselves and just see where the patterns are in the questionnaire. But one of the questions is, you know, do you have a heightened sense of empathy? That's one of the things that a UFO researcher, or excuse me, a UFO abduction researcher will ask someone in a questionnaire, you know, in order to, not so much prove or disprove that they're an abductee, but just sort of see if they, you know, like they fit a pattern.
Yeah, well, that's part of the revised version of the UFO experience or the UFO researcher's bag of tricks or bag of tools that we were talking about earlier. Yeah, sure, we want to know what time of the day it happened, and sure, we want to know what it looked like, and sure, we want to know how big it is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we also want to know, how did it make you feel? That's number one. What were you doing, like you said, right before that? What happened?
You know, one of the things that shows up that's interesting before, like people will say, like, hey, I've always wanted to see a UFO. Like, that comes up a lot. Huh. And then they'll see one.
Well, maybe that's a predictive thing where that either maybe it's a recursive thing where, one, they're, you know, exteriorizing the wish, and two, maybe it heightens their sensibility about what's going on, or maybe, you know, that it's a beginner's luck thing. You know how they have with psychic stuff, with remote viewing, something like that. Everybody does, not everybody, a lot of people do real well right out of the gate.
Same with meditation. Yeah, people can get into a deep state of meditation the very first time they try, and then they can never get back into that deep state. Yeah,
yeah, and then I think in a microcosm, it's kind of like what happened to me when I had had a kind of a Satori experience where I did this, and I've mentioned this on the show too. I did a experiment or something where I stopped assigning meaning to sensory input, and it's really hard to do. If I heard a bird, I would just think of it as a sound, or a car, I would think of it as a sound. And you do this at night and you close your eyes. But at a certain point, I realized that I became unhooked from I don't know what it is, from time or whatever. I had that sense that all time and all history and all future and all that were present at that moment that I was there. And at that point I went, oh my God. And as soon as I gave in to the amazement or amazement. As soon as I gave in to the amazement of the experience, it shut off. And I think that might be going on too with the UFO thing, like where somebody says, I want to see it, and then it happens, then maybe it never happens again. But it was just exteriorizing that wish through that switch, maybe within them or with whatever they could connect to have that. Or if you want to be really way out and a real UFO, you know, fanatic, it meant the aliens heard you and came and showed up.
Or just the opposite, where you sensed that the UFO was about to approach, you know, psychic means, whatever that might be. And, you know, you blurted that out at, you know, sensing that this event was just about to take place.
Yeah. And then the other questions come in, you know, what happened afterwards? Did your life, you know, follow up with these people? Did your life change? Did your friends change? Did your religious views, like you said, change? Poltergeist activity, any kind of paranormal activity around you? All kinds of questions that were never on these and still aren't on these questionnaires that they have to ask of UFO sighting, you know, people that have UFO sightings or even any kind of paranormal experience for that matter. But for the purpose of what we're talking about now, all the, you know, I think Jacques Vallée had a kind of a matrix of experience that he came up with in the 1960s, which was very close to this model, but nobody ever followed it, I don't think.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, and in a weird way, I mean, I'm going to oversimplify it greatly, is that it's a bunch of men that are not interested in that touchy-feely stuff. They want to, you know, kick the tires, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's the mindset of I'm going to, you know, whatever, I'm kind of going out on a limb here and kind of being judgmental. And I mean, that seems to be the mindset of a big organization like MUFON.
Well, I think it is. You can't really get away from it. There's a group think there that, and it, you know, when I said it's that the get do away with the large UFO groups, that's just a, you know, that to me, that is a symptom of the kind of person I am. If I see anybody in a group, you know, kind of dressing the same way and doing anything and more than two people are doing it, I get intensely suspicious of it.
Sure.
And yeah. It's, you know, it comes down to the, it manifests by me saying, I think it should be more individualistic in the way we look at this and more creative in the way we look at this. And, you know, just a kind of a way that people haven't concentrated on before, because like you said, they're so interested in solving this thing and kicking the tires and let's have it land on the White House lawn and where's the government hiding the bodies and all this stuff. I think those are non-starter questions and stuff that will probably never be solved. That kind of stuff is never going to happen. I don't think.
And my sense is that, you know, that the UFO phenomena is going to evolve, you know, like as soon as we wrap our minds around some aspect of it, it'll, you know, slip away and just skitter just out of our reach in, you know, reform in a way that will be just as mysterious, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know what that might mean, but, you know, I have a feeling this experience, this phenomena, I don't think that there's going to be, you know, the president's going to stand on a podium and say, yes, you know, the UFO phenomenon is real. And then, you know, all of a sudden it's just going to be, everyone's going to slap their knee and go, golly, isn't that interesting? And this, and then, you know, the exopolitics thing, as far as like, you know, having sort of political relations. I mean, Jesus, if they're capable of completely distorting our ability to see what's in front of our eyes, you know, like we're not going to sit at some conference table and hash things out. You know, like this is not, you know, that is not going to play out like that.
Right.
You know, Stephen Bassett, I think, has this sense that, you know, there's this, that they're on an equal playing field as us. And we are, you know, there will come a day when it'll be just like Star Trek. You know, we'll all sit in a great big conference room and except the person on the other end of the, you know, table is just going to have funny ears compared to us or something. So.
Yeah, that's another thing that I've kind of hammered on the shows is if you're asking for a certain thing, that's all you're looking for. And we touched on this earlier too. If all they're asking for is, you know, release the files and tell us what we already know, that's, you've already defined something that that may not be even close to fitting into that model. So how can anybody admit to you something that it's like, I'm going to ask you a question that has nothing to do with what's going on. How can I answer that? How can that question be answered? It can't.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the it's elusive. I mean, the stuff is it is a mystery in the truest sense of the word. You know, it's mysterious.
Yeah.
And the more mysterious it gets, the more I dig it, you know? So I'm all for the, you know, like if someone's got a freaky, crazy, you know, unexplainable story, man, that's the story I want to hear. And you know, and this owl thing has been actually a really cool, you know, I'm seeing the pattern and so here's like that essay that you read, is kind of turned into a book. You know, like I got a lot of good feedback from it, and a lot of people started sending me, you know, more owl stories, and I had a bunch that I couldn't fit in just because they were too, you know, some of them are a little long and complicated, so they sort of take a little time to truly tell them.
Shaggy owl story.
Yeah. So and it just feels like it's a cool, you know, like it's just, you know, as silly as it sounds, it feels like I'm treading in, you know, in a different part of the pond, you know, like no one's really peered into this in any depth. I don't think I'm going to dig deep enough to find an answer. I know I'm not. And I'm kind of guessing and speculating all around the, you know, all dancing all around the outside of it. You know, maybe it could be this, maybe it could be that. And I'll have some stories that seem to paint, you know, that kind of, you know, like, you know, is it a shamanic initiation? Is it, you know, are the owls somehow attracted to the UFO experience? Are the owls being mind controlled by the UFO occupants? You know, all these things are, you know, maybe true at some level, or just might be, you know, my own kind of, you know, spinning my own wheels, trying to force something to fit the available data. But, yes, something very unusual is going on, and somehow I feel very strong saying this is that the owls are connected.
You know, just as you're talking about the owls again, I don't know why. I just thought of, remember the Kelly Hopkinsville thing from the 1950s in
Kentucky? Oh, yeah, the thing on the roof and the firing the guns, and yeah.
And the skeptic Joe Nickell's explanation for it. His explanation was that these people lived out in the middle of nowhere that were close to nature all the time were shooting at giant owls.
Sure, that's the Flatwoods Monster was supposedly you know, the misidentification of according to the skeptics, of a great horn, excuse me, a great gray owl, and then the same with the Mothman sightings.
Right, right.
Yeah. So yeah, that the owl shows up in that sense too, where it's the first thing people will point to. I mean, the owl is kind of like a, you know, a Rorschach test, you know, like it's kind of, I mean, there's so much mythology about owls. You can mold it into whatever you want. I mean, there's, you know, mythology that it's the thing of sign of wisdom. It's the, you know, gate to the underworld. It's the, you know, it's a sign of, impending death. It's a bad omen. It's a good omen. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff connected with owls, you know, throughout, you know, there's all the stuff with the Bohemian Grove and the big giant owl at the, you know, where they stage the rituals there in California and stuff. So, I mean, it's easy to pick and choose what you want as far as with owl at the, you know, as the source. So I'm being very cautious not to get sort of drawn into any one of them.
Yeah, well, Adam Gorightly wrote in and mentioned what we were talking about in our online conversation and the Twin Peaks thing about the owls are not what they seem. And I don't know if Mark Frost wrote that or David Lynch wrote that part of the story. And I don't even know how they used to – and I think there was an image of an owl that would trigger somebody's memory about the Laura Palmer murder. But that one phrase, the owls are not what they seem, is a very strange thing to happen in the middle of that show. And then, of course, there's a guy in there in the show called The Major. He used to be in the Air Force, or is currently in the Air Force, and he's involved in some kind of UFO research.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that the, you know, Twin Peaks came out after Whitley Strieber's Communion, and Whitley Strieber's Communion certainly had a bunch of, not a bunch, but there was a few owl references in that story where the memory he had after waking up on the, you know, the morning, December 26th or 27th, I guess would be the morning. You know, he basically turned to his wife and said, I think I saw an owl right outside the window, big owl right there on the window. And there was some snow that was on the windowsill, and there was no, you know, a little owl, you know, claw prints or talon prints in the snow. So that wouldn't have played out, because the, you know, if there had been something sitting on the windowsill, it would have left prints. So that as far as I can tell, now I haven't dug deep enough. I haven't done like a, you know, full database search of all UFO books, but that to me is the very first popular reference of an owl. And that very much plays out as the screen memory, because it doesn't seem like a real owl. The stories, you know, that seems to be the very first one that popularized the whole thing. And then, you know, Twin Peaks came after that. So, I guess there's script writers. All I got to do is get a hold of them and ask them in a way, you know, but that's my sense, is that, you know, that they were sort of riffing off of the popular memes that were already in place.
Yeah. And then I think at one point he goes out in the middle of the forest and he stands out in the clearing at night and he looks up and there's some light that responds to him up in space. And I don't, and you're left wondering, if is that some kind of a satellite, some military satellite, or is it something else? So it's that show had a lot of things going on that I don't think even, and if you ask Lynch on any of his stuff, he says, I don't exactly know what I was doing there.
And, yeah. And, oh, yeah.
It's not something where you say, oh, come on. It's like, no, I don't. I think he really didn't care what was going on there. He just thought it was the right thing to do at that time.
Sure. And he's also very good about, like, he doesn't do David Lynch doesn't do what do you call the DVD extras and the director voiceover, you know, on the because he's like, no, you know, like these stories are meant to be, you know, ethereal and mystical. And I'm like trying to explain them would defeat the whole purpose, you know. So, yeah.
And that's the, yeah, I really admire him for that. And it goes back to what we were talking about not lusting after the result and using the vehicle of whatever you've chosen as your avenue for discovery, rather than having a predetermined idea and then using that vehicle to push, to take you to that idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead. I had other questions. Is this diffuse? I wrote down about 8 questions. We've gone through most of them, actually.
Sure, fire away.
You know what? We never got to this, to the actual, or maybe we did, and maybe you answered it, and I was just being rude.
Oh, no, the thing
listening.
That happened in March of this year?
No, we can talk about that, too.
Oh, what was the other? What was the?
Well, the thing, see, I've run into this, and you mentioned Walter. You asked if he's going to be in the studio. He's not, but he's had a couple of strange experiences researching his books, his Empire of the Wheel books.
Now, and to me, that means he's on the right path. I mean, that means there's something there. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, he cannot explain that experience to other people and say, because it to them, to somebody that hasn't gone through it, it sounds patently ridiculous. Like, oh, you were just seeing things. It's like,
sure.
I knew what was going on. But the problem is, you can trust him and believe him or whatever, but you don't know. You can't know. So what? And I've had this discussed on the show too. What is this? You know, what is the difference between believing and knowing? And can you transfer that by telling somebody or writing a book about it or whatever? I don't know if it's possible unless that person has had a similar experience to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That's the, you know, I mean, you can believe that Jesus walked on water, right? I mean, there's a lot of people who do, but they can't. I don't think any meaningful way you can know that. You know, it's a very nice parable. It has, you know, all kinds of like kind of mystical implications, and it's a, you know, metaphoric and, you know, but you know, I mean, I know that, you know, I'm sitting in a chair right now, you know, I mean, there's a few things that I know. And so the way I say it is like, you know, I know that there's something going on in this overall UFO phenomena. You know, I can't go much beyond that as far as what I know. I can also say that I know that there is some connection between owls and the UFO phenomena. What it might be, I don't know. And that's about as close as I can get to making a definitive statement about this whole thing. You know, it's interesting. The owl thing also shows up in people who have had There's a woman, her name is Dr. Suzanne Gordon. She has done near-death experience research. And she's a pretty interesting woman. I did an interview. Actually, it's interesting. We just did a Skype call that I recorded because I wanted to just, you know, record it as notes. And it was so good that by the end of it, it's like, oh my gosh, we got to publish this. And so I cleaned up a little bit. There was a few names she used of colleagues that she just said, oh, take those names out. You know, these are academic folks and they probably don't want to be, you know, but, so I posted that online. Now she uses the term, STE. Spiritually transformative experience, you know, like a near-death experience or, yeah, or like a samadhi experience or a, experience on psychedelics, you know, so someone who has experienced an STE, a spiritually transformative experience, they will also occasionally have these owl experiences that play out just the same way that they do for the, you know, that I'm finding in the UFO lore. And that to me is like, that to me says that the, you know, what is at the source of this? Is it the spiritually transformative aspect of the UFO abduction experience that is manifesting the owls? Or is it the UFO phenomena that's manifesting the owls? Does that make sense?
Yes. It means it's and not either, or and not or.
Yeah, so,
probably it's more like and it varies from case to case.
Exactly, and so you know, there's folks that have I don't really have any good examples of anyone with a near death experience seeing an owl, but I certainly have someone. I have some experiences with people who have had like basically nervous breakdowns and then see, you know, owls, which I think is very interesting. And I mean, that can also be a spiritually transformative experience. You know, that kind of, you know, psychotic break.
I think I had an owl or maybe a bat experience one, and nothing to do with UFOs, but it was weird. Do you want to hear?
Sure.
I went in the 90s, I think the mid 1990s, to the Zuni reservation or villages or towns in northwestern Arizona, or northwestern New Mexico. I'm sorry, and I went there because I wanted to, you know, maybe do a story about the Zuni reservation because I was fascinated by it. I even subscribed to their local newspaper, like for that town in the Zuni reservation, had it sent to my house. That's how interested I was in the area. So I came out there and I talked to a few people, you know, that I said, I would like to do a story about Zuni. And of course they're like, oh, here's some weird person coming from outside. They want to do a story about us. And the Zuni, I guess, they're like the Tibetans in a way of the American Indian tribes. They're kind of distant. They would like to be that way. They don't really actively go out and make any big deal with anybody. They're not that public. They kind of have this, you know, they'd like to be left alone, basically. They can't, and they're gracious about it. But I went, you know, and they met me like in the nicest hotel in the area. A couple tribal members, like, you know, people that they send out to talk to people. I talked to them for, I don't know, about an hour. They told me about what they were doing and what was going on, how people felt about them, how they felt about the outside world, what kind of businesses they had to kind of keep the tribe going, because they're one of the few tribes that don't have gambling. They don't have any gambling enterprises. However, they do have real estate. And I said, can I get outside and take some pictures of you or some pictures of the place? And they said, no, we don't allow pictures here. And I said, okay, then I won't take any pictures. You know, fine. It's their place. I will honor them. The next night I went out, I was kind of walking around at sunset, just looking around at things. And there's this beautiful sunset. And I said, oh, I think I'll take a picture of it. And I took my camera out. And just as I was pulling my camera up to my face, this huge flying thing, I don't know if it was a bat or an owl or what, but it was silent, flew right in front of me. I mean, almost, I felt like I was going to be knocked over.
How big was it?
I don't know, but it blocked out the sun when it went by me.
That sounds like it's bigger than a bat.
It might have been an owl, I don't know, but I didn't even see it coming. It like came up from below me and went up, I think, or side. But I couldn't, and I was so startled, I didn't turn around to look. And then when I did look, I couldn't see anything. I couldn't see it. It was twilight too, so it was about halfway dark, so you couldn't see everything great. It could have been flying near the ground. I just couldn't see it. But anyway, it just happened to happen right when I was – and I wasn't doing it, so I'm going to sneak a picture. I'd just forgotten they told me that. And right as I'm about to do it, this whatever flying thing flies right in front of my face. And for some reason, I immediately remembered, oh, I'm not supposed to take pictures.
Huh. I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, that's, you know, so, I mean, you know, on one sense, was it like a mythic Native American tulpa that just manifested, you know, that they would have a name for, you know, the as opposed to a physical owl or physical bat, you know? I mean, was it, you know, what, I, you know, well, never actually know, so there's, but I mean, just wondered, did you ever ask, like, any of the elders there, like, tell that story?
No, I mean, I didn't figure I had, one, I had almost broken a rule, and two, I didn't figure I knew anybody there well enough to be asking such silly questions.
Yeah.
Because I was like, you know, then there's another thing. I don't like coming to a Native American person and saying, you know, it gives me that feeling like there's an old Firesign Theater album where these hippies come out to talk to these Indians. They go, oh, we're going to come out and we're going to be doing all these beautiful nature things that you Indian people do. Got any peyote? You know, that kind of thing.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. The whitey. Yeah,
I have no idea about their mindset, and I do not want to make a presumption, which is why I did not ask.
Yeah.
Anyone. The other mistake I made was somebody there, the guy that was cleaning the tables at the restaurant, I talked to him and he said, why don't you come up and visit? I live in, and it was like this little village up on one of the mesas, far away, not far away, but probably about 30, 40 minutes away. Come up and visit me. I live up in this one area. So he told me where the house was, and I went up and I actually, like, went up to the door, and, like, I didn't knock on the door, but nobody came out. I didn't see anybody the whole time we were there, and there was a little village, and there was nobody there. My friend Robert and I were there, and nobody came out. And I was wondering, what the hell's going on? But that's kind of a Southwestern and Native American thing. You don't go up and bang on somebody's door or yell for them or anything. You go out, you park in front, and you sit there till somebody comes out. Otherwise, you're being rude, but I didn't know that.
Huh, interesting. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I mean, that's not only an Indian thing. My wife told me that that's what they do out in the ranch lands, too. You don't go up and bang on somebody's door. They know that you're coming. They know. They can hear it. And you don't have to go up and bug them about it. If they don't want to be bothered, they don't want to be bothered. Because we didn't hang out and go, where are you, or anything like that. We just left. We figured there was nobody around, or they just didn't want to talk to us, which was probably true. Or maybe the guy just wasn't there at that time, and they didn't know who the hell we were. But yeah, the custom is to pull up in front of somebody's property outside of their fence, but where they can see you, and wait. And I think it's also from the days of, you know, living out in the middle of nowhere. You don't want somebody coming in and sneaking up on you or doing anything untoward. And if you come up, you just sit right in front of their property and show that you have no ill intention. They're more likely to come out and say hi and what's up and whatever.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the question is, what did you see? Yeah, that's very interesting.
I don't know what I saw. And the other thing is, I don't know if that's an accurate representation of what happened specifically. I do know that I was going to take a picture. I do know that I was told not to do it. And I do know that this thing that flew in front of me and made me almost duck made me remember that I shouldn't take the picture.
And it was silent.
And it was silent.
Which matches both UFOs and owls.
Yeah.
Less so bats. Bats do make a little flapping noise.
They do, but yeah, I mean, you can't hear. Have you ever sat around and like a bunch of bats flying around? You must have.
And actually, I have. I've been in caves and stuff where they're flying around. They're pretty flappy. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but if you just encounter one or two out somewhere, you can't. Depending on the bat species, I guess you can't really hear it unless they're really close to you. I was in a swimming pool out in the desert at real late at night, and I realized there were bats flying all around my head around the swimming pool. And I also realized I could hear drops of water hitting the swimming pool. And it's like, where's that water coming from? And I realized it wasn't drops of water hitting the swimming pool. It was the bats swooping down and taking drinks of water. And it just made this little noise like a drop of water.
Oh, interesting.
But I could not hear them flying. They would fly right at my head and then go around me because, you know, they couldn't see me, but they could, because of the echolocation, they knew that they didn't want to run into me. And I couldn't hear them going by. They were silent. But that was that one species of bat, whatever it might be, Mexican free-tailed bat, I guess, that was out in the desert there. Anyway, to go back to what the experience was, I just it was just a very weird, I don't know if it's a synchronicity or a weirdness or a some, you know, weird mystical Indian thing, or I have no idea, but it was, it does really stick out in my mind as when you mention owls, it's something that happened to me. And I said, that was either a bat or an owl. I don't know which, because they're both quite silent when they fly.
Yeah.
As far as I know, it's owls especially.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't have a good answer. Yeah. But it is something that adds to sort of the, oh, you know, the mystical lore, you know, almost like the preconception, you know, almost, I almost want to say the, you know, the pop culture preconception about, you know, being on an Indian reservation, you know, that like a little mystical thing would happen like that.
Yeah. If you find it useful and you want to include it in something, you put it in your database there and whatever you want to do with it, that's fine. But
yeah,
that's the only real connection I have to what we're talking about, at least personally.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, I've spoken with Walter about, and he's had crow experiences with crows.
Yeah.
And then some people I've talked with that have, you know, well, these things will manifest themselves as, or they'll have, you know, hawk experiences. And then I've actually talked to other folks who have hummingbird experiences, which is very interesting that these birds seem to show up and play that kind of role, that kind of, you know, the same role that a synchronicity would play.
Yeah. Now I have gone through just about all the questions. Oh, I know you do your main source of income or your job is being an illustrator, right?
Yeah.
Has any of this, one, has it kind of influenced your work? And two, as I thought of now, just as I'm asking you the question, is there some recursive thing about your experiences that affects your artwork in a basic way?
No, not really. You know, most of the stuff I've been doing the last few years have been these sort of instructional books on, you know, skiing and camping and stuff like that. So, you know, just the opposite almost in the sense that, like, there's almost no overlap at all between, in fact, I can't think of any overlap at all between, except every once in a while I just did a little kid's ski book and it was really fun to, you know, I stuck in, you know, along, you know, so it's like little kids skiing. It's teaching kids the ski book. It turned out cute. I draw these cute cartoons. And so there's like, you know, I had to draw these wide open scenes at a ski area with like little kid, you know, in among the crowd. So it was really fun to put, you know, hippopotamuses and stuff skiing and wizards and things like that. So you kind of, it's like no fun just to draw like regular normal
people.
So, and I did sneak in a few owls and a few aliens, the classic gray aliens, like, you know, on, you know, waiting in line at the chairlift kind of thing. So
yeah, that's great.
So yeah, but I mean, I would have done that anyway with, you know, I mean, I sneak Elvis in and stuff like that every once in a while. So, you know, that there's been no overlap at all.
This I thought of when I was driving around and listening to music. What kind of music do you like, Mike? And I don't even care that it has any relevance to anything else we're talking about. I just want to know.
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I actually kind of have a soft spot for really obscure kind of scratchy old 45s and stuff like that. You know, so I do get a kick out of the stuff you play. It's like, ooh, that, you know, when I was living in New York City, which I spent my 20s, I moved there when I was 19 and I moved when I was 29, left when I was 29. But so for a decade, I lived in New York City. And in that decade, I kind of befriended a bunch of kind of record collecting kind of nerds that really influenced the, you know, what I listened to. So actually, I listened to a ton of sort of surf music from the 60s.
Oh, wow.
You know, I've got a really pretty big collection of surf music. And then I've got, you know, I have a huge soft spot for Fats Waller.
Really? Me too.
Oh, yeah. So lots of Fats Waller.
He's like eating a really nice meal that's just patting you on the back, telling you everything's okay.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just joy. It's this certain kind of joy that I think is, you know, forever lost. Where, you know, here's this sort of vaudevillian that kind of was in his element.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't have to. You know, I don't think he ever had to rehearse or anything like that. Yeah. And just, you know, so it's him. And I guess he was accompanied by a band at times, but oftentimes it's just him at the piano.
Yeah.
Just. So wonderful.
I have some Fats Waller 78s. I actually do, amazingly.
Oh, yeah. See, I don't really make the attempt to, like, you know, get vinyl or anything like that. So,
Oh, this was years ago. I must have got them 20 years ago.
Yeah. But yeah, so that, you know, I'm whatever kind of, you know, I don't listen to much new stuff. You know, a lot of old, you know, 60s psychedelic stuff, and kind of I have a soft spot for the Ramones. So,
oh, good for you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting, the kind of stuff that, you know, curiously enough, the stuff that really, you know, in my formative musical listening years, which would have been my 20s in a way, you know, the stuff that really, you know, turned me on then is the stuff I'm still kind of re-listening to over and over again. You know, that's when I got turned on to surf music, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you know about Takashi Terauchi? I've played him on my show. Japanese surf guitarist from the 70s. 60s and 70s. Well, then I'll have to send you some MP3s. I think you'd like them.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. No, I don't know anything about them.
There's the, not really to belabor the UFO point thing too much, but I don't know if we talked about this last time, but favorite books on the UFO subject. What are they?
The three books that Vallée did: Revelations, Confrontations, and Dimensions.
Right.
Wow.
That's good and loud. We only had the siren once, I think.
Okay. So yeah. So those three would be super vital and important as far as, you know, the stuff I've read. What else? Oh, there's a book that Bud Hopkins did called Sight Unseen, where everyone says, you know, oh, Bud is just trapped in this box. He only sees the UFO abduction thing one way. And that was his final book on the abduction phenomena.
Right.
And that one is really weird. I mean, he's basically like says, okay, here's a bunch of cases that are extremely strange and I can't make sense of them. And he's trying to fit him a little bit into the box of, like, you know, if it was technology, how would this technology work? But yeah, he tells some very, very weird, trippy sort of stories that I just, you know, I thought were great. You know, those that series. What else?
Maybe I ought to read it, because when I heard him talk about it, I was thinking,
yeah, you should read that one's great. You know, it's interesting because it's written with his ex-wife Carol Rainey, and she's the one that sort of came out of the woodwork and just kind of, you know, as he was dying, you know, basically said that, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge story about Linda Napolitano, you know, was all made up. He was hoaxed or being, you know, led astray on a hoax or something like that. So it's very unclear.
Yeah.
You know, she was kind of insinuating a lot of stuff. She never came out and said, you know, what. But anyway, there's the story is written in sort of back and forth chapters, and one of them is written by Bud, and then the follow up chapter sort of says, you know, like, well, if there was a scientific way to look at this, you know, how would scientists, you know, dabble with the manipulation of time, for instance, you know, or invisibility or mind control, you know, these kind of things. So those are in alternating chapters, and I just didn't bother reading. All I read was the sort of UFO report stuff and not the speculation on, you know, how it transposes to science. Uh-huh. And that's how I would advocate reading that book.
Right.
That was interesting to me too. I tried to read both, and I just kind of, you know, was too eager to get to the next chapter that Bud had written.
Right. Any other ones that stick out in your mind?
Oh yeah. I've got hundreds of them in the house here, and there's some that are great. You know, the Allagash abduction one is pretty darn interesting.
Oh,
by Raymond Fowler.
I have that. I never got through that whole book. Maybe I should.
Well, I mean, it's just kind of, it's, you know, a story told by four people, and they all sort of tell fairly close to the same story. There's some tiny little differences in their recollections, and, you know, just sort of talks about the investigation and such. That one I remember liking a lot. You know, I guess Whitley Strieber's Communion really holds up well.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, as far as, like, someone who doesn't try to come to a conclusion and, you know, goes so far as not even mentioning alien, you know, he doesn't even use the word alien in. I'm sure he does, but I mean, but, you know, he chooses to use a different vocabulary word. That one holds up beautifully. You know, that one's almost over 25 years old now, and that one is just, I listened to it, Roddy McDowell narrated or read the sort of book on tape version of that, which is abridged. But you know, so Roddy McDowell with that beautiful voice, and you know, and just, like, whatever, it was just slayed me hearing, you know, hearing him read that.
Yeah. Wow, I gotta. I there's got to be one of those available online somewhere.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's easy to get online. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think you can download it if you're a member of Whitley Strieber's website.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah, and then it's totally available. Just I just got it from Audible.com and just listened to it that way. Yeah, right. It was great. So what'd you think of the Owl essay? Even though you're not quite done with it.
I'm fascinated to read the rest of it because I want to see. You said it gets even weirder because I said, you know, what if the Grays are screen memories? Like, and you said it gets even weirder than that. Read it. So
yeah. So well, I mean, I don't really speculate on whether the Grays are screen memory, but it does definitely, you know. So I feel like I should tell an owl story, like from either from that essay or from my own experience.
Yeah, please do. We've got about 5 minutes here.
Okay. There's this woman in.
I'll actually play something from Takashi Terauchi, which you.
Oh yeah,
like.
That would be great. Yeah. So there's a woman in England. Her name is Bridget Barclay, and she's fairly outspoken. She speaks at conferences and stuff like that. She was actually worked on a book for a while, and the book kind of I think, you know, she chose not to pursue it after a while. So there's a book basically written about her experiences now. I also talked to two other people who were involved in this event. She tells a story of when I spoke to her for a long time on the phone, and then also talked to the two other people that had this peripheral stuff going on around her. She went to an electronics store and wanted to get a printer scanner. And the it was nighttime, and the printer scanner, you know, whatever. She was in the aisle. She was looking at these things, and she kind of had picked one out. But she wanted to talk to the guy, and the guy was busy. So she said, "Oh, I'll just come back later." So she goes out to her car, and the parking lot is pretty close to empty. And she walks up to her car, and leaning against the car is a printer scanner that is out of the box, sitting there, brand new, leaning against the car. She's like, "Oh God, what does this mean?" You know, and she's kind of like, "Is someone playing a joke on her?" And she felt like she scanned the parking lot, thinking that someone was spying on her. She got really paranoid, like someone was playing a joke on her, and she didn't know what to do. And I was like sitting there, like basically right next to her car. So she picked it up, put it in the car, and drove away. Now on the drive home, she turns this corner, and there's this one very specific corner. She turns this corner. She hears the words in her mind very clearly. She hears, "I see you," and then bam, this owl hits her windshield. Now, at this, she stops the car. She backs up. She's thinking she's going to see some dead owl on the road or in the bushes next to the, so she doesn't see any dead owl. She goes home and she tells her teenage son what happened. And she, you know, the teenage son is like, "Get that printer scanner out of the house." And so she has this funny story about pushing the printer scanner out of the house. Now, there are these other folks involved in the story, and they had been – are you there?
Yes, I'm there. I'm just covering up the microphone because of the sirens.
Oh, okay. I get you. So, yeah, not only sirens, but yeah, the honking of the fire engine there. Okay, good. So that makes me feel good. So I achieved the proper Radio Mysterioso effect there. Yeah. So she finds out later, she tells a close friend that about, you know, what happened and what time it was. And she said, you know, just before the owl hit, I had heard the words, "I see you."
Yeah.
And she, the person, her friend that she was talking with, went back and looked at a Facebook conversation, these two people had been having a back and forth Facebook conversation, and these two people both knew her. One of them is for sure speaks very openly about being a UFO abductee. The other one tells a lot of stories that imply some sort of, you know, connection to the overall UFO phenomena. I don't want to use either of their names. They've asked me not to. During their back and forth Facebook conversation, at the moment of the owl hitting the windshield and her hearing the words, "I see you," one of them had written the words, "I see you," in a Facebook thing. And, you know, it has a time count on it. So they figured it was pretty close to the same time that the owl hit. Now, this same corner is where earlier she had been driving at dusk. She saw something off to the side, and it was a, like a glowing floating orb, and she pulled off and watched it, you know, sort of flying around the trees and stuff like that. So these events, you know, so here's this owl event that is tied into all these other weird synchronicities. The story is a little bit longer and more complicated than I'm trying to than I can share easily in a little short time here. But one of the other things that each person I talked with individually, and each person talked about this in this little triangle of the three people, each talked about this like heightened sense of tension and this heightened sense of anxiety around that event. Right. Literally, one of them at the time that she wrote the words "I see you," there was thunder that came out of nowhere above her. You know, it was this person would have been in California. It was a clear blue sky. It was nighttime in England. It was daytime in California. Yeah. And, you know, booming thunder came that pretty much matched the same time as the owl hitting the windshield. Now, so, you know, there's no culmination to the story. There's no answer to the story. There's just this convergence of these kind of overlapping stories, including, and this woman made no bones about the fact that the owl hitting the windshield freaked her out. It was so terrifying to be driving and then have this thing thud right into her windshield.
Yeah.
So
amazing. Hey, we've got probably about 2 minutes left. If there's any information you want to give out or your website again, and then I will play something from Takashi Terauchi, which isn't specifically surf, but it's pretty crazy guitar, and I think you enjoy it.
Great. Yeah. So as far as like anything I was sharing, the website of mine is just a blog, and I have done a ton of audio interviews. I've probably got about 130 hours of audio interviews that are all posted, mostly focused on the, you know, alien abduction lore, whether speaking to people who have the direct experience or folks that are doing research. The website is hiddenexperience.blogspot.com, or you can just Google my name, and usually the first thing that comes up is that blog. The owl essay, which, and also here I'll put a plea out. Anyone with any weird owl stories, send them my way. My, you know, along one of the sidebars of my site, you can scroll down and it's got a little contact information as far as my email address. So I'm all for hearing interesting owl stories. I want to collect these.
Okay.
And then if you scroll down on the right hand sidebar, just right near the top, there's a photograph of a great horned owl, and it says, long format essay, UFOs and the owl, Owls and the UFO Abductee is the name of the essay. So,
okay, great. Thanks so much, Mike.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks.
Yeah. And I promise I'll put this up pretty soon as in contrast to other things I've been doing.
Yeah, no worries.
Mike Cleland, and we'll talk to you again soon and have you on again. And maybe after that owl book comes out, we'll talk about it more in depth.
Great. Oh, and also, I pitched the owl thing to the conference that the International UFO Congress that takes place each year in February in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I pitched them this idea that I feel pretty darn confident I can talk for an hour and a half about owls and UFOs. So that's, I'm going to give a talk about owls and UFOs coming up at in February.
Okay, great.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Mike. And I'll talk to you soon.
Right on. Bye.
All right. Bye. Yeah, Mike Cleland. Let's play this Takashi Terauchi. Stay tuned for At the Show with Bob, and we'll see you next week. Is that working? Yeah.